Then he smiled again and stood up, peeled a dollar bill off his roll, and left it weighted down on the tabletop under the detective special. Stepped back to the hallway, all quiet. He made the 10 paces to the back and came out into the light. Checked left and right up and down the alley, and stepped over to the parked sedan. Opened the driver's door, and found the lever, and popped the trunk. There was a black nylon sports bag in there, empty. A small cardboard box of 9mm reloads under a tangle of red and black jump leads. He put the ammunition in the bag and walked away with it. The pizza was waiting for him when he arrived back on Broadway.
CD 7
Tripwire by Lee Child. It was sudden. It happened without warning. As soon as they were inside and the door was closed, the man hit Cheryl, a vicious backhand blow to the face with whatever was inside his empty sleeve. Marilyn was frozen with shock. She saw the man twisting violently and the hook swinging through its glittering arc, and she heard the wet crunch as his arm hit Cheryl's face, and she clamped both hands over her mouth as if it were somehow vitally important she didn't scream. She saw the man spinning back towards her and reaching up under his right armpit and coming out with a gun in his left hand. She saw Cheryl going over backward and sprawling on the rug, right where it was still damp from the steam cleaning. She saw the gun arcing at her along the exact same radius he had used before, but in the reverse direction, coming straight at her. The gun was made of dark metal, gray, dewed with oil. It was dull, but it shone. It stopped level with her chest, and she stared down at its color, and all she could think was, "That's what they mean when they say gun metal." "Step closer," the man said. She was paralyzed. Her hands were clamped to her face and her eyes were open so wide she thought the skin on her face would tear. "Closer," the man said again. She stared down at Cheryl. She was struggling up on her elbows. Her eyes were crossed and blood was running from her nose. Her top lip was swelling and the blood was dripping off her chin. Her knees were up and her skirt was rucked. She could see her pantyhose change from thin to thick at the top. Her breathing was ragged. Then her elbows gave way again and slid forward, and her knees splayed out. Her head hit the floor with a soft thump and rolled sideways. "Step closer," the man said. She stared at his face. It was rigid. The scars looked like hard plastic. One eye was hooded under an eyelid as thick and coarse as a thumb. The other was cold and unblinking. She stared at the gun. It was a foot away from her chest, not moving. The hand that held it was smooth. The nails were manicured. She stepped forward a quarter of a step. "Closer." She slid her feet forward until the gun was touching the fabric of her dress. She felt the hardness and the coldness of the gray metal through the thin silk. "Closer." She stared at him. His face was a foot away from hers. On the left, the skin was gray and lined, the good eye was webbed with lines, the right eye blinked. The eyelid was slow and heavy. It went down, then up, deliberately, like a machine. She leaned forward an inch, the gun pressed into her breast. "Closer." She moved her feet. He answered with matching pressure on the gun. The metal was pressing hard into the softness of her flesh. It was crushing her breast. The silk was yielding into a deep crater. It was pulling her nipple sideways. It was hurting her. The man raised his right arm, the hook. He held it up in front of her eyes. It was a plain steel curve, rubbed and polished until it shone. He rotated it slowly, with an awkward movement of his forearm. She heard leather inside his sleeve. The tip of the hook was machined to a point. He rotated the tip away and laid the flat of the curve against her forehead. She flinched. It was cold. He scraped it down her forehead and traced the curve of her nose, in under her nose. He pressed it against her top lip, brought it down and in, and pressed until her mouth opened. He tapped it gently against her teeth. It caught on her bottom lip because her lip was dry. He dragged her lip down with the steel until the soft, rubbery flesh pulled free. He traced over the curve of her chin, down under her chin to her throat, up again an inch, and back under the shelf of her jaw, until he was forcing her head up with the strength in his shoulder. He stared into her eyes. "My name is Hobie," he said. She was up on tiptoes, trying to take the weight off her throat. She was starting to gag. She couldn't remember taking a breath since she had opened the door. "Did Chester mention me?" Her head was tilting upward. She was staring at the ceiling. The gun was digging into her breast. It was no longer cold. The heat of her body had warmed it. She shook her head. A small, urgent motion balanced on the pressure of the hook. "He didn't mention me?" "No," she gasped. "Why, should he have? Is he a secretive man?" She shook her head again, the same small, urgent motion, side to side, the skin of her throat snagging left and right against the metal. "Did he tell you about his business problems?" She blinked, shook her head again. "So he is a secretive man." "I guess," she gasped, "but I knew anyway. Does he have a girlfriend?" She blinked again, shook her head. "How can you be sure?" Hobie asked. "If he's a secretive man."
"What do you want?"
she gasped. "But I guess he doesn't need a girlfriend. You're a very beautiful woman." She blinked again. She was up on her toes. The Gucci heels were off the ground. "I just paid you a compliment," Hobie said. "Oughtn't you to say something in response? Politely?" He increased the pressure. The steel dug into the flesh of her throat. One foot came free of the ground.
"Thank you,"
she gasped. The hook eased down. Her eyeline came back to the horizontal, and her heels touched the rug. She realized she was breathing. She was panting in and out, in and out. "A very beautiful woman." He dropped the hook away from her throat. It touched her waist, traced down over the curve of her hip, down over her thigh. He was staring at her face. The gun was jammed hard in her flesh. The hook turned, and the flat face of the curve lifted off her thigh, leaving just the point behind. It traced downward. She felt it slide off the silk onto her bare leg. It was sharp, not like a needle, like a pencil point. It stopped moving. It started back up. He was pressing with it gently. It wasn't cutting her, she knew that, but it was furrowing against the firmness of her skin. It moved up. It slid under the silk. She felt the metal on the skin of her thigh. It moved up. She could feel the silk of her dress bunching and gathering in the radius of the hook. The hook moved up. The back of the hem was sliding up the backs of her legs. Cheryl stirred on the floor. The hook stopped moving, and Hobie's awful right eye swiveled slowly across and down. "Put your hand in my pocket," he said. She stared at him. "Your left hand," he said. "My right pocket." She had to move closer and reach over and down between his arms. Her face was close to his. He smelled of soap. She felt around to his pocket, darted her fingers inside, and closed them over a small cylinder, slid it out. It was a used roll of duct tape, an inch in diameter, silver. Maybe 5 yards remaining. Hobie stepped away from her.
"Tape Cheryl's wrists together," he said.
She wriggled her hips to make the hem of her dress fall down into place. He watched her do it and smiled. She glanced between the roll of silver tape and Cheryl, down on the floor.
"Turn her over," he said.
The light from the window was catching the gun. She knelt next to Cheryl, pulled on one shoulder and pushed on the other until she flopped over on her front.
"Put her elbows together," he said.
She hesitated. He raised the gun a fraction, and then the hook, arms wide, a display of superior weaponry. She grimaced. Cheryl stirred again. Her blood had pooled on the rug. It was brown and sticky. Marilyn used both hands and forced her elbows together behind her back. Hobie looked down.
"Get them real close," he said.
She picked at the tape with her nail and got a length free, wrapped it around and around Cheryl's forearms, just below her elbows.
Tight, he said, all the way up.
She wound the tape around and around, up above her elbows and down to her wrists. Cheryl was stirring and struggling.
Okay, sit her up, Hobie said.
She dragged her into a sitting position with her taped arms behind her. Her face was masked in blood. Her nose was swollen, going blue. Her lips were puffy.
Put the tape in her mouth, Hobie said.
She used her teeth and bit off a 6-inch length. Cheryl was blinking and focusing. Marilyn shrugged unhappily at her, like a helpless apology, and stuck the tape over her mouth. It was thick tape, with tough reinforcing threads baked into the silver plastic coating. It was shiny but not slippery because of the raised crisscross threads. She rubbed her fingers side to side across them to make it stick. Cheryl's nose started bubbling and her eyes opened wide in panic.
God, she can't breathe, Marilyn gasped.
She went to rip the tape off again, but Hobie kicked her hand away.
You broke her nose, Marilyn said. She can't breathe.
The gun was pointing down at her head, held steady, 18 inches away.
She's gonna die, Marilyn said.
That's for damn sure, Hobie said back.
She stared up at him in horror. Blood was rasping and bubbling in Cheryl's fractured airways. Her eyes were staring in panic. Her chest was heaving. Hobie's eyes were on Marilyn's face.
You want me to be nice?
He asked. She nodded wildly.
Are you going to be nice back?
She stared at her friend. Her chest was convulsing, heaving for air that wasn't there. Her head was shaking from side to side. Hobie leaned down and turned the hook so the point was rasping across the tape on Cheryl's mouth as her head jerked back and forth. Then he jabbed hard and forced the point through the silver. Cheryl froze. Hobie moved his arm left and right, up and down, pulled the hook back out. There was a ragged hole left in the tape, with air whistling in and out. The tape sucked and blew against her lips as Cheryl gasped and panted.
I was nice, Hobie said. So now you owe me, okay?
Cheryl's breathing was sucking hard through the hole in the tape. She was concentrating on it. Her eyes were squinting down like she was confirming there was air in front of her to use. Marilyn was watching her, sitting back in her heels, cold with terror.
Help her to the car, Hobie said.
Chester Stone was alone in the bathroom on the 88th floor. Tony had forced him to go in there, not physically. He had just stood there and pointed silently, and Stone had scuttled across the carpet in his undershirt and shorts, with his dark socks and polished shoes on his feet. Then Tony had lowered his arm and stopped pointing and told him to stay in there and close the door on him. There had been muffled sounds out in the office, and after a few minutes the two men must have left, because Stone heard doors shutting and the nearby whine of the elevator. Then it had gone dark and silent. He sat on the bathroom floor with his back against the gray granite tiling, staring into the silence. The bathroom door was not locked, he knew that. There had been no fiddling or clicking when the door closed. He was cold. The floor was hard tile, and the chill was striking up through the thin cotton of his boxers. He started shivering. He was hungry and thirsty. He listened carefully. Nothing. He eased himself up off the floor and stepped to the sink, turned the faucet and listened again over the trickle of water. Nothing. He bent his head and drank. His teeth touched the metal of the faucet and he tasted the chlorine taste of city water. He held a mouthful unswallowed and let it soak into his dry tongue. Then he gulped it down and turned the faucet off. He waited an hour, a whole hour, sitting on the floor, staring at the unlocked door, listening to the silence. It was hurting where the guy had hit him, a hard ache where the fist had glanced off his ribs. Bone against bone, solid, jarring. Then a soft, nauseated feeling in his gut where the blow had landed. He kept his eyes on the door, trying to tune out the pain. The building boomed and rumbled gently, like there were other people in the world, but they were far away. The elevators and the air conditioning and the rush of water in the pipes and the play of the breeze on the windows added and canceled to a low, comfortable whisper, just below the point of easy audibility. He thought he could hear elevator doors opening and closing, maybe 88 floors down, faint bass thumps shivering upward through the shafts. He was cold and cramped and hungry and hurting and scared. He stood up, bent with cramp and pain, and listened. Nothing. He slid his leather soles across the tile, stood with his hand on the doorknob, listened hard. Still nothing.